Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. So the midterm elections are 3 weeks from tomorrow, and a new Washington Post ABC News poll finds really unusual levels of voter interest for a non-presidential year. Are you surprised? 77% of registered voters say they are certain to vote or have already cast an early ballot. That's 12 points higher than their poll taken just before the 2014 midterm elections. And listen to some of these demographic breakdowns. Certainty to vote is up 24 points among non-white voters compared to the 2014 poll. By contrast, white women without college degrees, generally a Republican voting bloc, only had a 12-point greater likelihood to vote, half the people of color increase. And in a reflection of the Trump and Me Too eras, certainty to vote is up a whopping 32 points among women under 40 compared to 2014. One reason is because President Trump keeps saying things like this. This is from 60 Minutes last night as CBS's Leslie Stahl pressed Trump on how he mocked Christine Blasey Ford.
Do you think you treated her with great respect?
I think so, yeah, I did.
But you seem to be saying that she lied.
You know what? I'm not going to get into it because we won. It doesn't matter.
Well,
we won.
Doesn't matter how I treated her, we won. The Washington Post says its poll finds Republicans' certainty to vote did go up faster than Democrats since the Kavanaugh-Blasey Ford story broke, but it also finds 33% of registered voters said the Kavanaugh debate made them more likely to vote for Democrats. That's 6 points more than the 27% who said it made them more likely to vote for Republicans. I'll add one more stat. Washington Post reporter Philip Bump notes that 30% of seats in the House of Representatives currently held by white men are considered in play. 30% of seats in the House of Representatives currently held by white men are considered in play, seats those incumbents could lose. Philip Bump, Washington Post national correspondent, joins us now. Hi, Philip. Thanks for starting off our week. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you.
So 30% of seats in the House of Representatives currently held by white men are considered in play. Are those overwhelmingly Republican seats?
Yes, they are. I mean, that's really what the correlation is there. Most of the seats that are in play this year are Republican seats. Most members of Congress who are Republican are white men. And so it is that overlap. But I think that the interesting thing about that data point is how it encapsulates the primary tension of this year's midterm elections, which is seems to have shaken out to be overwhelmingly about women, and particularly women of color, facing off against mostly Republican white men. And I think that number sort of encapsulates that.
Right. And the 30% is a total of 85 seats in the House currently held by white men considered in play. 85 seats in play currently held by white men. Do you know how many of the challengers in those 85 districts are women or people of color?
It's a great point. Most of them are white men facing other white men. So, yes, it is the case that white men are being challenged and that a lot of white men are actually facing off against them. But that said, there is an historic number of women who are actually on the ballot who made it past the primaries to the general election. A lot of them are running in races that are not expected to be contested and are not likely to win as a result of that. But I don't know off the top of my head what the actual percentage is, but your point is well taken that those white men are likely to, if they lose their elections, be replaced by other white men.
So the House is likely to be more diverse after the election. The question is by how much?
Exactly. And the answer to that, the likely answer to that, is probably not that much.
Huh. What do you make of the Kavanaugh-related numbers in the poll? It looks like the issue has given the Republicans a little bigger potential turnout boost than they had. But overall, Kavanaugh is a net negative for the GOP, but just by a few points?
Yes, exactly. And so this is a post-ABC poll that was just reported out over the weekend. I'm going to be curious to see how that lasts over the next 3 weeks. I mean, we've seen one of the main characteristics of the political debate these days seems to be that everything has about a 36-hour shelf life. So it'll be interesting to see if this this actually manages to keep powering forward, despite the fact that it's 3 weeks out. You know, one of the key things to keep in mind about the midterms is that Republicans usually turn out better in midterms, and that's been one of the reasons that in recent years they've had more successful elections in 2010, 2014, is that Republicans tend to be older, they tend to be whiter, they tend to be wealthier, at least in terms of that sort of turnout. Those are the groups that turn out more often anyway. And so to have Republicans be more energized than they were earlier this year is going to be important for them. But to have Democrats be energized when Democrats normally don't turn out for midterm elections, that could make a significant...
Whoops, did we just lose Philip Pump? Phil, you there?
I'm here, I hear
okay.
you. Yep.
Sorry, we had a dropout there for a second. Maybe you can square two things that we usually hear about the Republican electorate, and you just said one of them, that Republican voters tend to be better off economically.
Right.
But at the same time, we hear that Trump's base is white working class voters who are not better off economically, whereas white college educated voters are more likely to go Democrat.
Yes, that's exactly right. So there, you're right that there's a lot of sort of circles to this Venn diagram. The key thing is that Trump's base is not the normal Republican electorate, right? So the normal Republican electorate are the sorts of folks that I was just describing. This, we're speaking in broad generalities mm-hmm. here. Obviously, there's a lot of nuance that's sort of being elided. But Trump's base is really seen as being these non-college-educated white voters who came out, who might not normally have voted and who came out to vote in 2016. Whether or not that's a fair description of them not voting regularly is itself subject to debate. But one of the things to remember about non-college educated is that that itself correlates with age, and that the percentage, the density of college education, college degrees among Americans increases as you decrease in age. Older people were less likely to have gone to college. It just wasn't as big a thing 40, 50 years ago as it is at this point in time. So there is a correlation that exists. We sort of have this idea that when we talk about non-college educated voters, that we're necessarily talking about people who, you know, have low-paying jobs, who never chose to go to college, and you know, therefore, sort of have different styles of careers. I think that's sort of the implication one gets from that, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily accurate. So that said, the important thing here is that there still are a lot of Republicans who aren't in that demographic, who tend to come out and vote very often, who tend to be wealthier, who in 2016 may have been more reticent to support Trump, but eventually came out and supported him in that November anyway.
My guest is Washington Post national correspondent Philip Bump, and we can take your phone calls for Philip on anything pertaining to the midterm elections, also to the Khashoggi situation, which we will get into, as well as the related, to some degree, return of American evangelical pastor Andrew Brunson from Turkey over the weekend. And we'll talk some about campaigning for or against civility in different ways in some of the campaigns. So anything on any of those things, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Your comments and your questions, welcome. Staying on that new Washington Post ABC News poll, how about those certainty to vote numbers compared to the midterms in 2014? Women under 40 likely turnout up by 32 points compared to the last midterms. All the other likely increases pale by comparison. A lot of first-time voters among them?
Right, yes, exactly. I mean, this is going back to the point that we were making at the outset. This is I think, the thing to watch in 3 weeks' time is the extent to which women turn out to vote in this election. One of the most dramatic shifts that we've seen in the electorate since 2016 is white college-educated women turning against the Republican Party. It's been a really, really, really dramatic shift that we haven't seen among other demographic groups, and that's a function of a lot of things. Trump's election itself, the Me Too movement, the events over the past year, probably to some extent the Kavanaugh nomination as well. And it's going to be fascinating to see. I mean, obviously there's a gap between self-reported certainty to vote and actual voting.
Right.
But I feel pretty confident that there is going to be a big surge in voting among women this year that probably is not great news for the Republican Party.
We know that 53% of white college-educated women voted for Trump in 2016. It'll be really interesting to see what percentage of that same group, white college-educated women, votes for Republicans for Congress, or for that matter, for governor in their states in 3 weeks from tomorrow. And the poll did find that Trump got his first positive approval rating as president for his handling of the economy in this poll, 49% to 46% positive on his handling of the economy, the first time he was above water in a Washington Post ABC News poll on that, though his overall approval remains underwater at 41% positive to 54% negative. How do you think that plays in an election where Trump is holding rallies almost every day now and telling people in those competitive races that the election is about him?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's not a great message for him because, yes, he likes to celebrate the strength of the economy. Obviously, the economy is doing well for most Americans at this point in time. There are certain perceptions of how the economy is doing that are tied to partisanship, which I think are worth noting. I mean, right after the election, there's a huge surge in Republican confidence about the economy that, you know, this was 2 weeks after Donald Trump won, which, you know, there's definitely a partisan overlay here. But that said, I actually looked last week at the history of job approval for presidents versus the unemployment rate. And the unemployment rate in particular is a very poor guide. While it is one of the signal metrics that Trump points to as to how well the economy is doing, it's a poor guide to what presidential approval looks like. Presidential approval is based on a lot more than just perceptions of the economy, although obviously Trump would like to tie the two pretty closely together for obvious reasons. If you look at someone like Lyndon Johnson, the economy, the unemployment rate was fairly low during his presidency, but he became extremely unpopular because of the Vietnam War. George W. Bush was very popular right after 9/11 and very unpopular as the Iraq War ground on, regardless of what the unemployment rate did. There are perceptions of the president which are independent of how the economy is doing, and in the case of Donald Trump, there are a lot of people who, if they themselves got, you know, a 50% raise directly because Donald Trump did something, will still not like Donald Trump as president because of all of the other factors that relate to his presidency.
I want to move on to the situation involving Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, increasingly believed to have been murdered by the Saudi Arabian government at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Right. Philip, first of all, my sympathies and shared outrage with everyone there at the Washington Post. Did you know him personally, or do you want to say anything about his work as a columnist or the reaction of the Post newsroom as a whole?
I did not know him personally, no. You know, I think that one of the things that I've been really impressed by, I shouldn't be surprised by it, but I've been really impressed by the ability of my colleagues to compartmentalize our emotional feelings about having this happen to someone who works with our organization and still do straight reporting and still do objective looks at what actually happened to him. It's the best of what the Post is, and I'm really proud of our team for doing that.
What's the latest on the investigation as of this morning?
So as of this morning, there is going to be apparently an investigation by Turkish authorities of the Saudi embassy itself. There were reports from news crews on the scene that there was a cleaning crew that had come into the embassy this morning as well, which I'm not sure if that's related. But obviously we had those comments from President Trump this morning in which he sort of granted a lot of accommodation to the Saudi government's denial that anything had happened. The Post has done a lot of reporting on this over the past few days, including the revelation that U.S. intelligence agencies had this audio recording, or rather that they had heard from Turkish authorities that there was this audio recording of what had actually happened to Khashoggi inside the embassy. And, you know, the burden of proof here certainly seems to be shifting toward the Saudi Arabian government having to show how what the where the evidence points isn't the proper conclusion to come to, although President Trump seems to be giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Right. The burden of proof falls to the Saudis, according to everybody except Trump, apparently. And for our listeners who were listening to the BBC just before we came on, that they played that clip of Trump from just a while ago saying that King Salman has denied any knowledge of what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. And it reminds me so much of the way he talks about Putin and Russian interference in the 2016 election, saying, yeah, it looks bad, but, you know, Putin denies it, and he denied it very strongly. So he's playing both sides of that same kind of coin with respect to Saudi Arabia and this killing?
That's exactly right. I mean, Donald Trump has a very flexible idea of what proof is necessary depending on how he feels about something politically, right? I think it's extremely interesting that he made those comments the same morning as Elizabeth Warren came out with this documentation that she potentially had some Native American heritage, something which Trump had been crowing about for months. He sets this standard of what he demands of his opponents for proof, and yet when it comes to something that he doesn't want to acknowledge, something that's politically tricky for him, it's an entirely different standard. We've seen that with Roy Moore. We've seen that with Brett Kavanaugh. We've seen that with Russia. We've seen that with Saudi Arabia. He has this divergent sense of what's required of his opponents and what's required of his allies that really played out in stark terms this morning.
What's the Elizabeth Warren story? Do you have that?
Yeah, so Elizabeth Warren had been criticized for a long time by Republicans generally, and Donald Trump in particular, for having claimed that she had some Native American heritage. The Boston Globe reporting this morning, and Warren herself tweeting out on social media that she had actually sat down with a researcher from Stanford University who concluded that, I believe it was 6 to 10 generations back in her family, there was someone that had Native American DNA. It's, you know, and this is sort of a murky science. It's worth noting at this point in time, but this is something that was just reported this morning, and Trump at a recent rally said that he would pay $1 million to a charity of Warren's choice should she actually take such a test, and so she's already taken him up on that challenge to provide that $1 million. So
did she say what her charity of choice would be?
She did. It was a charity dedicated to indigenous women.
How about that? So, yeah, and she had always said that it was just a little bit of Native American blood, but because it was there and the family knew it was there, it was part of the family lore, family conversation about themselves, which is believable. If you know, I know white families who've taken, individuals who've taken like 23andMe tests and come up with just a little bit of black heritage. And it transforms the way they look at themselves. So,
yes.
Just a thought about context. Back to the Khashoggi situation. By way of contrast, there was a White House event over the weekend to welcome back an American evangelical pastor, Andrew Brunson,
right,
who had been taken prisoner by Turkey a few years ago, as you know, and finally released this weekend after intense pressure from the Trump administration. Interesting that it was now, and that it was Turkey who had him, that released him, just as Turkey wants the U.S. to press the Saudis over the Khashoggi incident, which took place on Turkish soil. Any relationship there?
Trump claims that it's all coincidental. I think there is certainly reason to suspect that perhaps it was something less than coincidental. But we don't know for a fact at this point in time that there was any direct link between the two.
Is it a stretch to say we have a case of a victim considered worthy by Trump world, Pastor Brunson, and a victim considered unworthy, Khashoggi, who is a Muslim immigrant to the United States, one of the things that Trump most, you know, wants to reduce, and a Washington Post columnist, no less?
No, I mean, I think that Donald Trump has certainly made his loyalties clear in those regards, but I think that the probably the bigger factor for Trump is the relationship with Saudi Arabia, the fact that this is something that there's been worldwide outrage at Saudi Arabia's potential role in this potential killing, not to reuse that word there, but that Donald Trump doesn't necessarily want to have to break ties in any significant way with Saudi Arabia, I think maybe the more compelling thing for him at this point in time.
Because I had a very exciting weekend, I listened to the Brunson Welcome Home event live as it was taking place on Saturday afternoon. And he's from North Carolina, and I want to play a clip that hasn't made the news very much, but that I could hardly believe my ears when I heard it go by. This is Republican Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina at the Welcome Home ceremony. Listen to how he frames what the United States is all about in relation to Brunson's work.
His work in Turkey, like everywhere else in the world, to spread the word of Jesus Christ is absolutely crucial, and it's a foundational thing about this country, the United States, and I think that's why we love it so much. Welcome home.
Spreading the word of Jesus Christ in a Muslim country is an absolutely crucial and foundational thing about the United States. Does Richard Burr say that a lot? Do you have any idea?
I don't know that he says that particular thing a lot. I mean, it certainly is the case that for religious evangelicals, in particular, the idea that the United States was founded as a Christian nation is something that has a lot of resonance and comes up with some regularity. So I'm not surprised to hear it, no.
And by contrast, here's how Trump brought up Khashoggi's status to diminish his importance publicly last week.
Khashoggi is not a United States citizen, is that right? Or
permanent
is that
resident.
Right? He's a permanent resident, okay. We don't like it, John. We don't like it, and we don't like it even a little bit. But as to whether or not we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, knowing they have four or five alternatives, two very good alternatives, that would not be acceptable to me.
Not a citizen, just a permanent resident, then goes on to a strong argument that we shouldn't punish Saudi Arabia too much. And here's an older clip of Trump that TV News was using this weekend to establish a possible conflict of interest that Trump might have in being the head of U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, and I get along great with all of them. They buy apartments from me. They spend $40 million, $50 million. Am I supposed to dislike them? I like them very much.
So in fairness, Phil, U.S. presidents of both parties, lest we forget history, have let the Saudis get away with all kinds of bad things
right.
for most of the last century without much pushback because of our dependence on cheap Saudi oil for the American lifestyle. So is Trump different in substance or only in his particular ways of being?
Well, it's a great question, this question of how another president would deal with the situation. I think it's fair to say that other presidents would similarly use kid gloves to some extent in dealing with the Saudis on this issue. There is certainly a question, though, as to whether or not the Saudi Arabian government would have done this with another president. There is some sense from experts that I have heard from and spoken to that there was an empowerment that was felt by the Saudi government based on the relationship with the Trump administration that may have led them to feel like they could get away with doing this. So far, the reaction from Trump suggests that that may not have been an erroneous assumption. But yes, you're absolutely right that this has always been a complicated relationship for American presidents. Under Barack Obama, the Saudi Arabian government essentially went to war in Yemen and has caused a huge humanitarian crisis there that the Obama administration said very little about. So yes, this is something that's been ongoing for some time, but the added complication here, going back to this idea of burdens of proof, we have no idea what Donald Trump's relationship with Saudi Arabia is financially. He doesn't release tax returns. He's not upfront about what those relationships look like. And so that adds this level of question about what are his ties? Why might he feel fealty to the Saudi Arabian government that another president may not? And quite frankly, if he, you know, if there's nothing in his tax returns which would suggest that he has any sort of reason to feel particularly hospitable to the Saudi Arabian government, it would have been in his benefit to have released his tax returns. But of course, he never did.
Len in Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Len.
Good morning. I just wanted to follow up on your discussion with about the Saudi journalist. Before you guys came on the air, I think I heard a news report from Trump explaining that the Saudi king has expressed that he had nothing to do with this disappearance or murder. And Trump went on to say that that it probably was rogue murderers. And I thought, oh, my God, here it is. The fix is in. This is going to be the excuse to march on with this king. This was rogue murderers who flew in on private jets, in a train of private SUVs, in and out of the Saudi consulate, back to the airport, back flying private jets to Riyadh.
Right, exactly.
Oh, here we go, the rogue murderers.
The rogue murderers. How much does that sound, Len, like, oh, who knows if it was Russia, it might have been China, it might have been a 400-pound man sitting on his couch.
Yes, it's just over and over the same thing.
Len, thank you for your call. Elizabeth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I do want to say that I worked a little bit on Deborah Ross's campaign for Senate against Burr in North Carolina, and yeah, he talked like that a lot. So the reason why I had called is I've been doing some work in Suffolk County in the New York 1st congressional race, which is Perry Gershon, who is challenging an incumbent Republican. The district has a history of switching back and forth, Republican, Democratic. It's totally purple. It really depends on who gets their voters out. And yesterday when I was knocking on doors, I spoke to, there were a lot of people not home, but for the people who were home, many of them were women, and many of them had real hesitation about voting for the incumbent, and my ability to get them to think about voting for a Democrat, which, as I could see from their registration, their registered Republicans would not necessarily be their first inclination, depended on their willingness to talk about an issue that was important to them. So if I could get them to talk about Medicare or health care or education, you know, sort of depending on their age and depending on what I could observe of their household might be an important issue, they were totally willing to consider a Democrat. And there were a couple of voters who by the end of the conversation were like, yeah, I think I want to vote for this guy. I think he represents my values.
Mm. That's a really interesting report from the field. I'm curious, and I realize this is just anecdotal with you as one canvasser, and for listeners who don't know that district, it's Lee Zeldin, the Republican incumbent, versus Perry Gershon, the Democratic challenger. Did you find that Gershon had much name recognition in the district, or did you have to introduce Gershon to them, but they knew who their congressman was?
They knew who their congressman was, and they also knew who the challenger was, which I thought was really interesting. My favorite was the 15-year-old who answered the door and said that, she said, my sister's not home, my dad's not home, but I just saw a commercial for this guy, and if I could vote, I'd vote for him. She was talking about a Perry Gershon commercial.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly has name recognition, which is great. And happily, most people seem to know who their congressman is, which, even though I don't like him, I think it's a good thing when people know who represents them in Congress.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. Christine in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I wanted to underscore the comments that both you, Brian, and Mr. Bump made about our relationship with Saudi Arabia over the years. This is just more of the same. I mean, it's an apartheid state. They behead people. President Obama, unfortunately, has underwrote their war against Yemen and the humanitarian disaster there. And there was an article in the Times this weekend about museums worrying about what to do with all this Saudi money. I mean, the question is, why were you taking it in the first place?
Yep, fair enough. And I'm going to go to somebody with a related point who wants to say more about the Saudis in Yemen. And listeners, you may remember if you were listening last Wednesday, we talked about this a little bit with the head of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband, who works with refugees around the world. And he calls Yemen the worst refugee crisis in the world at this moment. And Nina in Manhattan wants to expand on that, I think. Hi, Nina. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. I'm a great fan. I've never called in before. Yes, I just wanted to point out the headline from the BBC this morning that 13 million people risk famine and a lot are already dying of hunger. And I have the feeling this isn't getting enough play in the U.S. news. And I love your bullhorn, and I would like you to get that out there. I just called, for what it's worth, my congresspeople, my two senators and Jerry Nadler, and asked them to please make this front and center. People are dying. This is very serious, besides the sport reporter. So please, let's talk more about it. Let everybody please pressure the government. It's just horrible.
And by most people's lights, primarily with Saudi culpability. Nina, thank you. Thank you very much for expanding on that. Philip Bob, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Before you go, one other contrast. There's a lot of attention on former Attorney General Eric Holder for having changed or rejected Michelle Obama's famous line, when they go low, we go high, to when they go low, we kick them, at an appearance last week, I think. Republicans are saying he represents a Democratic mob. But I want to play a longer version of the Holder statement than the soundbite that keeps getting repeated, in which he makes clear he's not talking about physical violence.
Michelle says that, you know, when they go low, we go high. No, no. When they go low, we kick them. That's what That's what this new Democratic Party is about. We're proud as hell to be Democrats. We're willing to fight for the ideals of the Democratic Party. We're proud of our history. We're proud of our present, and we're proud of the future that we can create for this country.
Yes.
Now, when I say, you know, we kick them, I don't mean we do anything inappropriate. We don't do anything illegal, but we got to be tough. And we got to fight for the very things that John Lewis, Martin Luther King, Whitney Young, you know, all those folks gave to us. That stuff can be taken away. That's what they want to do. They want to maintain power.
And by contrast, here is Republican candidate for governor of Pennsylvania, Scott Wagner, in an actual campaign video that his campaign must have produced and posted on Facebook. It was on Facebook, referring to the Democratic incumbent, Tom Wolf.
Well, Governor Wolf, let me tell you, between now and November 6th, you better put a catcher's mask on your face, because I'm going to stomp all over your face with golf spikes, because I'm going to win this for the state of Pennsylvania, and we're throwing you out of office.
Okay, so compare and contrast, Phil. What was Eric Holder thinking, and what was Scott Wagner thinking?
Well, I mean, there's a long tradition of using war analogies and violence analogies and boxing analogies in politics. Part of it's because politicians and political activists and consultants like to feel tough, like to feel like, you know, they're engaged for a fight for the future of the country, and they like to sort of take that more literally than they really ought. But I think it's important to realize why this is becoming a thing now. There's a huge push on the right by the head of the Republican Party, by Fox News, to suggest that there's this huge wave of, as you put it, this Democratic mob of all this violence, of Democrats lashing out in ways that are unusual or particularly violent. And it's simply, it's almost entirely in bad faith. It is an effort to reinforce President Trump's primary argument in 2016 was he's going to be the tough guy, he's going to push back on crime, he's going to push back on violence, particularly from immigrants and terrorists, and now they're sort of trying to cast Democrats as a violence force that they're pushing back against. I went back last week and I looked at what had happened during the Tea Party protests of 2010. Very, very similar things. People being threatened, acts of violence, windows being smashed. You know, that passed, and no one was saying that this was a broad-based a threat of violence from the Republican Party in literal terms at that point in time either.
There is also a Hillary Clinton clip out there where she talks down the idea of civility, using that word, and says civility, you can't just play civil against a party that wants to destroy everything you stand for.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so there is this other question beyond this idea of there being mobs and violence and so on and so forth. There is this question within the party and within the left of whether or not it's appropriate, for example, to challenge Ted Cruz when he's out to dinner in D.C. with his wife. Now, there is no point in time at which there was an actual violent threat against Cruz. It certainly was uncomfortable for them, and I think that, you know, people can disagree as to whether or not that's a tactic that works. But essentially what we're talking about generally are forms of protest, and, you know, if there's one thing that is, I mean, protest is literally enshrined in the Constitution as something that people are allowed to and encouraged to do, and so, you know, it is the tactics that are deployed for those protests are subject to debate, but it's hard to argue that the protests themselves are inherently wrong.
I guess we could have a call, and maybe we will tomorrow, on what people consider civility in campaigns and when they feel that it's okay to breach civility in politics short of physical violence. Is it clear to you what Hillary Clinton had in mind when she said you can't be civil with a party that wants to destroy, you know, the values that you stand for and the interests of the people you represent? Did she define civility in any way, or is it clear what line she was talking about crossing?
I think she was referring to things like the Ted Cruz thing, like the calls that have been made, for example, by Representative Maxine Waters of California to challenge Trump administration officials when they're out in public. You know, those are things that, look, I mean, politics is all about trying to gain leverage over your opponents. And one of the ways that is very common to try and gain leverage over your opponents is by recasting what it is that they're doing in negative terms. there's absolutely an aspect of this which, as I said earlier, is in bad faith from opponents of the left. There certainly are, though, real questions about when and how it makes sense to offer your protests against elected officials. I think that's what Clinton was referring to. But I think it's important also, and I'm sure that, you know, most Americans would generally agree, that there it is not the case that the Democratic Party is engaged in the widespread violent mob activity against Republicans, although that does play to the political benefit of Donald Trump and his allies.
Right. And that guy Scott Wagner, the Republican candidate for governor of Pennsylvania against the incumbent Democrat Tom Wolf, the Republican putting out that video saying he's going to stomp all over Wolf's face with golf spikes. Is that a competitive race for governor of Pennsylvania?
It's not really. Wagner's losing badly. That video itself is sort of fascinating because he's standing outside underneath a billboard on the side of the highway, a billboard that is drawing attention to Wagner having sued Pennsylvanians for not paying their bills to his company. It's a really weird political video simply because he's drawing attention to one of the attacks on him, which is sort of rule one in the political playbook, is not to do that. And then you can see him just getting mad. It was a live feed. He's getting angry, and he makes that comment about the golf spikes, which then, of course, drew a ton of attention in the whole video in which he highlights his opponent's attack. And I think that's, you know, that sort of bad political decision-making is one of the reasons that he's losing that race.
Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And coming up next, unfortunately, there was physical violence outside the Metropolitan Republican Club here in New York on Friday night following an appearance by a Western supremacist or Western chauvinist leader, Gavin McInnes, and there are questions about who the NYPD arrested and who they didn't. Jake Offenhartz from Gothamist is all over this story, and he'll join us right after this.